So, in looking at the future of audio, I hope you'll indulge me in the fact that I'm going to take a mainly radio-focused view of it, but there are other aspects that apply across all of it, of course. So, in 1960, technology was kind of like this. If you had a telephone, it was like that, and it was bolted to the wall in the hall, and your television looked like that, and your radio was one of them. Of course, things have moved on a lot since then now. A telephone is one of these things. Televisions are 55 inches across and only half an inch deep. And radios, of course, have changed enormously. Just like that. So that's it, really. Of course, there has been development since 1960. In 1960, the BBC was just starting to roll out stereo. You could get it in London and Birmingham for about 3 hours a week. Everything else was mono. So stereo has become part of everyday life. We don't even think about it anymore. That's a development that's happened. So we've gone from one speaker to two. Not exactly groundbreaking. Everything's more portable, of course. There's hugely more choice. You get slideshows on the radio and other sort of interactive treats. But the actual sound hasn't really changed very much since we started doing stereo in the 1950s as an experiment, 60 rolled out across the country. In fact, I would argue that certainly for the pop music industry, which is an awful lot of listening, the sound has got very, very considerably worse since then. This is a little graph showing the waveform of Michael Jackson's Black or White, as originally released, a later re-release, and the most recent release. And what we can see is that when it was first released, there was quite a lot of variation in loudness, in time going along here, and loudness of the left and right channels, and there was this sort of real build-up towards the end, and it was nicely shaped and crafted. When it was re-released, everything was quite loud all the way through. And the most recent release, everything is louder than everything else, right the way through. There's no light and dark, there's no shading. The whole thing is horribly distorted. And why do they do that? Why do the record companies go to so much trouble to make the record 2 or 3 dB louder when the thing people are listening on has got a volume knob on it and the first thing they're going to do is turn it down? And if you take that sound and you turn it down so it sounds about the same loudness as this one did, what you'll find is you've got a very, very flat, lifeless performance with no dynamics to it, and it's distorted as hell. I've no idea why they do it, but they do. So it's a major issue. However, it's recognised as a major issue. Most of the record industry, the people who actually make the records, hate it, but the producers want to be louder than the competition. I could understand it in the days of FM radio, where you turned the dial and you stopped when you got to a loud station. Nowadays on the radio, you decide to listen to Radio 1 or Capital, you don't know how loud it is at the moment you hit that favourite or click that preset. And certainly with records, what does it matter? But they still do it. But some legislation may be coming to help. The public complain about the fact the adverts on television are very much louder than everything else. There's been some work done. If you Google EBU R128, European Broadcasting Union R128, you'll find out about some standards. We finally have, as an industry, an agreed way of measuring how loud something is, and that gives us a chance to do something about it. For the television industry, it's going to be used to make sure that the adverts aren't much louder than everything else, so you're not constantly pumping the volume control up and down. If it becomes the normal way of measuring the energy in a signal, how loud does it sound, rather than how many volts it is or how many bits it's using on a CD, then maybe the advantage of doing this will all disappear. And maybe in 2020 we'll be able to buy music to listen to that sounds as good as it did in 1960. I can't hope so. So that's my first prediction, is the sound quality will get better, but where we are now actually is a trough, and it's going to go back up. What about surround sound? I mentioned that we went from one speaker to two, but of course we've got surround sound, haven't we? Everybody has their sofa and their great big screen and their teddies and their speakers. We've got surround sound. Great. Well, it was designed for the cinema. It was designed for dialogue. It was designed so that if you were sitting in the cinema to one side in front of a huge screen, this great big speaker in the middle behind the screen would pull all the dialogue to the centre so that it sounded as if the sound was coming from the voice, the face you were looking at on the screen. It's a bit difficult in the living room, because for a start, you're not likely to be sitting right over here, so you don't need that. And putting a speaker in the middle of your telescreen is a bit awkward. And what if there's no picture? What if you're just listening to the radio? What's the relevance of having all this soundstage focused here and a bit of reverb back here? The other thing we've found is that a lot of people, when they buy their surround sound system, think, oh, I've got great, I've got five speakers. I'll put three in the living room and two in the kitchen. and surround sound really is rubbish. Because it's all level with your ears. Helicopters do not sound up there. Rain does not sound as if it's landing on the floor. It's all here. When you're watching a big screen, you see the helicopters up there and the brain thinks, oh, and the rain's hitting there and the brain... Take away the picture and it's all just here. It just doesn't work without the picture. So I think we need something rather better than this.
What can we do about it?
We can do wavefield synthesis. Wavefield synthesis is a mathematical model that says what you can do is recreate the absolutely perfectly the sensation of being somewhere with every sound coming at you from the precise direction it should come at you. You sit in the centre of a sphere of speakers, each one's driven with a slightly different signal, and you hear what you would have heard if you were at the concert or the event or the play or whatever it is. And I know you guys like an equation, so here's the equation for wavefield synthesis. And I'm sure you've all spotted the problem with this. And it's quite obvious, really, isn't it? In order for it to work properly, you need an infinite number of speakers, each fed with a slightly different sound. Now, mathematicians are quite happy with infinity. Unfortunately, it tends to cause friction between accountants and engineers. So I'm not convinced that that's the way to go for the average living room. But for cinemas, maybe. You can get actually quite a good effect with just 300 different audio channels. 600 speakers typically, 300 separate sound signals. And some companies, Fraunhofer are one, have done this. They've built a cinema which has got wavefield synthesis sound in it. And they can position, they can make it sound as if there's a loudspeaker on that chair there, and the sound is coming from that chair there. And you walk around it, and it really does still sound as if it's coming from there. Very, very effective, hugely expensive, whole racks full of technical equipment doing all the fast mother crunching to make it happen. So maybe for cinemas, not for your average living room. For the average living room, well, what might we do? Well, there's Peripheny. This is the BBC's R&D lab in Salford, part of it. And what we've got is a conventional surround sound setup, but we've also got a Peripheny setup. The nice thing about Peripheny is it creates quite a good three-dimensional sound, so it goes up and down, with just eight speakers. You have four in the top corners of your room and four in the bottom corners. And that's not a bad place to put speakers, actually. They're kind of out of the way. Maybe it would work. It's not perfect. It doesn't give you that perfect rendering of every sound coming from exactly the right place. But neither does stereo. And yet it was a big enough improvement on mono to become very successful. So maybe something like that will be a sufficient improvement on two-dimensional surround sound as we have it today that it will become popular. It's certainly not too difficult to do, technically speaking. But I think there's other ways in which surround is going to be very popular. It's headphones. I see a lot of people wearing very expensive headphones, sitting on the tube, sitting on the train, sitting on the bus, sitting at home because they're doing something while somebody else is doing something else. So we can give you perfect three-dimensional sound in an ordinary pair of headphones. It's not difficult at all. What you do is you get a dummy head and you stick a microphone in each of its ears, and you record something, and you put headphones on, and you listen to it played back, and provided your head is exactly the same size, shape, and density as that one, you get perfect three-dimensional sound. Doesn't tend to work terribly well in practice, because your head's not the same, and the other thing is, if you stick that to record a concert, it'll pick up a huge amount of ambience from all around. You won't necessarily hear the solo violin very clearly. So what can we do to improve the headphone experience? As I say, it does kind of work. I forgot to push the buttons while talking. This is always my problem giving presentations. I get carried away with the sound and don't do the video, the visuals. Head tracking. To make it work really well, you need head tracking. What's head tracking? If you're listening to a concert and you turn your head, the whole orchestra or rock band or whatever it is, don't turn, we should do that. They stay there, so you turn your head in it. That's one of the biggest problems for giving good quality immersive sound on headphones is that when you turn your head, it turns with you. It is technically possible to get around that. If you measure the movement of the head, you can process the sound that's being fed and get fantastic 3D sound. So this thing, it can store audio, it can play over headphones, it can measure movement. The whole solution is here, in this that we've all got. The only trouble is you have to glue it to the top of your headphones so it can measure your head movement. But seriously, it's only the movement sensors that need to be in the headphones. They're tiny, they consume very little power, they cost pennies. There is no technical reason why a pair of headphones can't measure your movement of your head. The signal can be processed to compensate for that so that when you move your head a little bit, the sound stays exactly where it is. And that's really key to giving an absolutely superb immersive experience. But it's not available commercially today. We can do it in the lab. You'll just have to take my word for it. It's stunning. So moving on to what we can do today. We can do some stuff to make binaural possible, and the BBC and others are experimenting with this. As I said, the real problem is, apart from the head tracking thing, you need to process the audio for the shape, size and density of your head, and to some extent the type of headphones you're using, so that you take into account the way the sound would bend around your head, your ears, your nose. And we did an experiment at Christmas where we made 6 different versions of the 9 Lessons and Carols available, 3 different head shapes and sizes, each for 2 different types of headphones. And we did a survey to ask people how well it worked for them. And over 200 people completed the survey. And what we're going to do now is analyse that to say, OK, if we want to do reasonably good surround sound on a normal pair of headphones from a normal iPod or whatever, how many different versions would we have to produce so that it would work for, say, 80% of the population? We haven't yet done the number crunching, but we will be doing more surround sound experiments. What does surround sound mean from the radio? There'll be a lot more of that coming. There'll probably be some drama coming up fairly soon. So, headphones, we can probably do it fairly soon. Speakers, it's more tricky. There is one exception where we could do it with speakers quite easily. To get good three-dimensional sound on speakers, you have to know where the person is sitting relative to the speakers. And there is one place where the people who do the manufacturing know where you are relative to the speakers, and they know you haven't put 2 of them in the kitchen, and that's in the car. You can get fantastic sound in the car, and it can actually give quite a good surround sound experience for 4 different passengers, even though they're sitting in quite radically different places and quite close to some of the speakers and not to others. So as another of my predictions is that car audio is going to move on way beyond where it is now. Some car audio packages are many, many thousands of pounds as optional extras. I've heard in the laboratory systems that make those sound like a Woolies clock radio. So huge, huge improvements in sound quality in cars, I think, are coming. So, having looked at where I think the industry is going to go, better quality sound, some sort of three-dimensional, headphones are going to be really important, and so is the car. What about personally? Well, for me personally, the future of audio is that I'm going to find the BBC will start to mix the effects in the music far too loud and I won't be able to hear the speech. And at about the same time, I'm going to find young people will start to mumble. And I'm afraid the future of audio is the same for all of us in that respect. We all will get age-related hearing loss. I've already got it. I'm in my 50s, for goodness sake, and I worked in rock studios and God knows what. So it affects us all, but most people don't know they have it. They just think the BBC's doing a rubbish job of balancing the sound. And of course, we could just balance the speech much, much louder so that people with age-related hearing loss can still hear what's being said above the effects and music and all the rest of it. But then you youngsters are not going to get the great immersive audio experience that you probably want. You're going to get something that's very shouty. So you're just not going to be happy. So what can we do about it? We did an experiment, and some of you may have seen this back in the summer, where we let you set your own sound balance. This was an experiment we did. Oops, I've just launched 2 of those because I'm impatient. This was an experiment we did back in the summer with a company called Fraunhofer in Germany, who are an audio research establishment. And we took some audio, live tennis matches from Wimbledon, and we let the audience decide how the sound balance should be. So we gave them a simple player with a play button on it and a volume control and this thing. And if you slide this thing down towards court, you will hear mostly the sounds of the ball being bounced and served and going backwards and forwards and the crowd. And if you slide it that way, you will hear mostly the commentary with not very much of the sound effects. So the sound system is not ideal for a group this big, but we'll give it a go.
Djokovic crouches down low. He has his feet very wide apart to receive serve, and it's working for him. He plays a backhand drop shot now from Djokovic. Sokas racing after it, gets to it, plops it up. Now the attempted lob, not high enough. Backhand overhead from Sokas, who's now back at the baseline. Plays a forehand, they're now trading ground shots. Sokas going to come into the net again. Takes that off his knees, it just falls in, he's going to go past. No, he's there with a dive volley, and still the ball's out.
Idea. In the middle is the default balance that we would normally broadcast, and you can decide if you want more commentary or less. Now, if you have a hearing disability or are getting older, you will probably want a bit more commentary. If you really know your tennis and you are watching this on the TV, we only did it on the radio over the internet, but if you're watching it on the TV, you might not actually want the commentary because you can see what's happening, and you might just want the experience of being at Wimbledon on centre court, so you'd slide it the other way. And so we did a survey for this one as well. I'm very fond of surveys. Stick some stuff out there to find out what the audience think. It's much better than sitting in meetings thinking what they might think. And we did the survey, and what we found was that almost as exactly as many people moved it a bit that way as moved it a bit that way. So the best we can do is dissatisfy everybody equally. But one day, this kind of technology may allow you to customise the sound to suit yourself. So one day, every radio, television, mobile phone, everything might have two knobs on it. One for volume, and one that I don't know what it's going to be called, but it might go from I want something really, really clear to I want something really, really immersive. And some, or anywhere between the two. And the beauty of this technology is that we don't actually transmit two different things. We still transmit just one normal stereo signal and a little bit of clever control data. So if you've not got the latest fancy player, it will still play that same piece of audio just with the default balance in the middle. So we don't have to do two versions, it's backwards compatible. So that's it. That's my personal view of the future of audio. I think it's traditional to have questions, is it?
Yeah. Has anyone got any questions?
What's the, apart from just speaking normally, what's the most perfect sound you've ever heard electronically? Is there somewhere you've sat and said, this is as good as it gets?
Yes. In a research establishment in Germany where they have a room with 24 very, very high quality speakers. The Japanese are keen on a surround sound system called 22.2. Where you have 22 little speakers and two big ones. And if properly set up in a good environment, it can be absolutely stunning. Of course, the Japanese would be keen on an international standard that would require you to buy 24 speakers, because they make a living. Oh, gosh, what a lot of questions. OK, start at the middle there.
Hello. As a former dissatisfier of audiences or studio manager, as you might call them, do you really think that people are going to add, manufacturers are going to add an M&S component onto a radio to enable what you're suggesting? It feels to me as though what the BBC needs to focus on is delivery of a wider variety of formats of audio content. You know, kids on the bus blaring music out of a phone aren't going to be interested in 22.2 sound systems. They're going to want to be able to hear a piece of audio that's been tweeted successfully on their phone rather than being told that they've got the wrong version of the flash player.
I think you're right. It's very, very difficult to share on social media audio. It's very easy to send a photograph.
It's not difficult. We need to just send everything as MP3s. I'm sorry.
That doesn't work. That doesn't work. Because if you're listening to live radio and you want to share what's just happened on the Chris Miles show, how do you send that precise, that's where I was listening?
You talk and tell it straight away and then you send it over a social network.
Yeah, but that requires you to do that.
Yeah, no,
I don't want the audience to have to do that. I want the audience to just push a button and that precise piece of audio gets shared. We're working on that, it's coming. But I disagree with you fundamentally that the kid on the bus doesn't want good quality sound. There's been some research done in the United States that shows that actually kids on the bus are expert listeners. They listen to an awful lot of audio, and given the opportunity, they can tell the difference between rubbish audio and good audio, and they will go for the good audio, given the choice.
Do you honestly think that consumers are going to be... You know, is my wife going to allow me to put 22.2 channel sound system on my...
No, probably not, and mine neither, and certainly not the 300, but I do think that maybe the idea of one speaker in each top corner and one in each bottom corner might be a goer, or a lot of very, very small ones. Or the other came up with the idea of the skirting speaker. It doesn't have to be one. It could be 10 tiny ones. If they're built into the skirting board, you're not even going to notice it.